The Civil War was officially over in April of 1865 when Robert E. Lee surrendered to General Grant. But the historian Annette Gordon Reed says Confederate generals in Texas kept fighting for weeks, well into June. In a new book, she explains how Texas became a land in turmoil during those weeks, where you had defeated soldiers rioting and looting. So the Union Army sent a man named General Gordon Granger to impose some order. But he was also sent to tell the people enslaved there that they were free, that they'd been declared free for more than 2 years, because really they had no idea. Gordon Reed says on June 19th, General Granger landed in Galveston with this order announcing the news. General Order Number 3.
The order was brief, but it also said something else that I find quite interesting. He talks about the former enslaved people being in a state of absolute equality with everyone else in Texas. That is to say, the people who had enslaved them and the people who probably aspired to be enslavers, that they would be on equal footing.
This part is important for Annette Gordon Reed. In her book, she says, just announcing the end of slavery would have been shocking enough, but General Granger goes even further in this order. He put the former enslaved on what she describes as the same plane of humanity with white people.
They would be on equal footing. That was not something that he had to say. He could have just said, slavery was over, go on your merry way. But he added that, and I think it harkens back to Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, this idea of equality of rights as a basis of being an American were brought forth in General Order Number 3, and that, of course, made enslaved people, would have made them very happy, but it also made people who had formerly enslaved them unhappy.
You say the idea that things could be transformed from oppression to equality. It influenced black Texans in much the same way the Declaration of Independence influenced blacks in the early American Republic.
Well, it put forth or raised the hopes that life would be different. One of the most moving things that I found was a voter registration list with my great-great-grandfather's name on it in 1867. Thinking about what that meant, the idea that he could be a citizen and exercise the rights of citizenship along with others, that was a very hopeful thing for people who had been treated as chattel 2.5 years before then. So this would have been taken as a statement of hope and a statement for a brighter future.
And Gordon Reed can trace her own celebration of Juneteenth with her family growing up in Texas back to that moment when things looked so hopeful. And even knowing just how things would play out, how white people didn't think black people were on the same plane, how discrimination and violence would persist, people still celebrated.
Their actions at the time in setting up these celebrations that have continued from that time period till today indicate that hope and faith were both parts of their understanding of what had happened on that day.
Does it represent a theme in some ways of raising expectations for African Americans and then sort of dashing them in reality? Is this just part of a cycle or a theme that you've noticed in history?
Well, there's backlash. There were people at the time who had an interest in maintaining slavery and then also maintaining the racial hierarchy that slavery helped to create. And you can expect that they would not take it lying down. And we see that. Jim Crow, a way of trying to get back as near to slavery as possible. Slavery had imposed controls just by the nature of the institution. But once that was gone, there had to be other ways of keeping people in their place. And that seems to be something that is existing today. There are people who question or act as if there's a question about black people's equal citizenship.
There are these stories about people who celebrated They called it Emancipation Day or Jubilee, and they were punished. They were whipped. And yet they still went on, you mention, going about their lives, reuniting with family sold away, attending school, celebrating Juneteenth, as you say, come hell or high water.
They knew the society they were in. They knew how people viewed them. But it's a story about human resilience and that connection, this notion that we have to do something to commemorate the past, but also hope for the future. It's just very moving to me and a very powerful expression of the human spirit.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Annette Gordon-Reed is joining us to talk about her book called On Juneteenth. She's a professor at Harvard University. She won a Pulitzer for her book, The Hemingses of Monticello. But this new book is much more than a history of the holiday and the role Texas played in the larger story. It's a memoir, too, of her life growing up in Texas. She filters the history through her own family and through her own memories of the place. But as she told us, it wasn't easy writing about herself, at least not at first.
I had written a piece for The New Yorker about Juneteenth last year, and the year before that, I'd done a piece for the New York Review of Books, 5 books about Texas history, all aspects of Texas history. And so I've been thinking about Texas in a very serious way over the past couple of years. And during the pandemic, as I was sitting here in Manhattan, there was really nowhere to go except to Central Park and go for the daily walk in the park. And I would see the tents from the overflow of hospitals because of the COVID pandemic. And all of this had me thinking about mortality, thinking about my parents who are no longer living and what they would have made of this particular moment.
Yeah.
And that's when I decided to do something more personal, that I would write about Texas, but I would tell Texas history through stories of my family, my family life and my family's lives over the years. So I wanted a memoir. I didn't want it to be self-indulgent, to talk too much about myself, just enough to open up a discussion about slavery, about indigenous people in Texas, about myths of Texas, and the holiday itself on Juneteenth.
You grew up in this East Texas town of Conroe, about 50 miles, I think, north of Houston. Describe it. What was it like? This is a good part of what you work through in the book, some of these essays. But talk a little bit about what it was like and whether or not there was an awareness of race, what you noticed about that when you were growing up.
Well, Conroe, when I grew up there, was a town that was probably about 4,000 to 6,000 people.
Yeah.
When I first moved there. I was born in Livingston, Texas, about 50 miles northeast of there. But my parents moved to Conroe when I was about 6 months old. So it was a spread out sort of rural town. It was a prosperous town. It was founded as an oil town. And there was a sawmill there. And I remember reading that at some point in the 30s, there were more millionaires in Conroe than any other place similarly sized placed in the country. So it was a prosperous town, but it was a town that had a terrible reputation on the question of race. There had been lynchings in the town. A man was burned alive at the stake in the 20s. Yeah. A man had been murdered in a courtroom, a defendant on trial, and a family members of the person whom he was supposed to have attacked shot him, and in full view of the judge and the jury and spectators, and the person was acquitted.
So acquitted in 2 minutes or something.
Something ridiculous amount of time.
Yeah.
And those kinds of things gave the town naturally a very, very bad reputation. Some members of my family refused to spend the night in Conroe.
Right.
I think not just because they were frightened, but I think there was almost a matter of principle that they were not going to go to sleep in a place like that. On the other hand, it was a small town. I had a small town childhood, riding my bike around very freely, going barefoot in the summer, hanging out with cousins and, you know, kids in the community. I think I would say I had a happy childhood.
Yeah.
And despite all of that, but that's the weird thing, the strange thing about the South and these Southern towns where everything seems on the surface, as long as there are no points of friction everything goes along pretty smoothly and everybody gets along. I'm putting these in quotes, but there's always the possibility of violence, the possibility that one could overstep boundaries and drastic things would happen. So even in the midst of all of this, and I guess kids, if you have your parents and you know, people love you and they're supportive of you and most things are good, you think of, you're happy with your life. I wasn't thinking, you know, I did think about race, obviously, when I went to school and I integrated our town's schools, that made me think even more about race and what the problem was, what mm-hmm. the issue was with that. But for the most part, it was a fun childhood, even though there was this overlay of potential racial, you know, terror in some instances. Problems with police. One of my brother's acquaintances or friends, someone that I knew, was a 17-year-old boy who was arrested for disorderly conduct, and he ended up being killed in the jailhouse. Those kinds of things happen. And there was always the specter of potential violence based on race.
I want to ask you about origin stories because it's kind of a theme in one of the essays. You mentioned that origin stories, you say, matter for individuals and they matter for groups of people. Explain why. Why are origin stories important?
Well, origin stories orient us. They tell us who we are, where we came from, and again, give us a sense of why we are the way we are as human beings. I think that my origin in Texas, having grown up in Texas, give me a particular outlook on life. We were just talking about race and how those attitudes were formed in that particular place, and they influence the way I think about things now. For countries, obviously, when people go back and look at the founders, a notion of the founding of the nation, people think that's important. We argue about it. They're arguing about it now in Texas as we speak about how we think about origins. And it's evidently important to people. And there are different views about how we should view those origins. There are people who say, you know, you should talk about the bad things that happen with the good, along with the good things. And there are people who insist that that's unpatriotic, that that's not the thing to do, that you should emphasize the good for young people, for kids in school. So they're important because we think they're important. I suppose we could say that they don't matter, but it's hard for me to imagine maneuvering without that orientation of how we got to where we are.
Yeah. It's so interesting to see you in the book work through and try to find, as you describe it, that equilibrium, that balance between your affection for part of your past and the horrible parts of the past. It's kind of like, as you describe it, memory and mythology. And you say in the book that memory and mythology both have their uses. Could you explain what you mean by that? They're both there. There's mythology, there's memory. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I think because it seems to be present in every human society, some recurring to mythology and memory that shades into mythology, where you think you remember things and then you draw lessons from them that's supposed to tell you about what your country is and who you are. We all do that. They do it in France, they do it in the UK. People in the Americas particularly do it. I was speaking with a historian from of Latin America some years ago, and he talked about the fact that both people in North America and South America fixate on founders quite a bit, and that's because it's so new to us, so close to us compared to, you know, England, for heaven's sakes. You go back to King Alfred or something. How do you, what is an origin story for a place like that? Or yeah. China, 5,000 years. But this is all new to us. And we use these stories, our memories, our and mythology, some myths that we put forward to try to bind people together. And sometimes the problem comes when the story that you're telling requires some people in that group to deny a part of themselves or to pretend to be okay with the fact that the myth contains some aspects that aren't truthful in ways or in ways that are detrimental to their well-being. And I think Black people in the United States and Black Texans very often find themselves in the position of saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, we understand the uses of mythology, but that part of the myth where you are covering up the fact that there was this heavy emphasis on slavery, say, in the Constitution of the Republic of Texas, we can't pretend that those sections aren't there.
Yeah.
And you can't pretend that they did not do violence to and harm my ancestors who were in Texas. I could trace on my mother's side, back at least to the 1820s in Texas, before it was a republic. And they were human beings in this spot. They were under the legal control of other people because of slavery, but they were no less human. And so we have to be able to tell a story that takes account of their interest as well. Hiding that to make another group of people comfortable is immoral. There's a problem with that. And that's what we're contending about now.
Annette Gordon-Reed, she's a professor at Harvard University. Her new book is called On Juneteenth. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the acclaimed historian Annette Gordon-Reed. We're talking about her new book called On Juneteenth, which is a history of the Juneteenth holiday and its origins in Texas, but it's also a memoir of how it shaped her family's life there and her own. How are you feeling these days about the rest of us celebrating Juneteenth? You write about you write about that twinge of possessiveness that how could people, you know, outside of Texas, ever really understand what that meant. How are you feeling about that? And talk a little bit about that.
Well, I've gotten over the Texas chauvinism on that point. You know, I did. I went off to college and I started seeing people who – hearing about people who were celebrating. And I thought, what gives? I mean, how do you know what this really means when it didn't happen, you know, where you grew up? And, of course, then I realized later on that Texans who had left Texas and part of the diaspora who've gone other places – took the holiday with them, and that's how people came to know of it. But right now, I'm fine with it. I think it's we should have. I think there's a hunger apparently to have a day to talk about emancipation, to commemorate emancipation. Emancipation took there was a process, obviously. It went over time, but Juneteenth is a fun word. And there are fun traditions associated with it, and it's caught on. And I think, you know, almost all states now have some form of recognition of it. And lots of institutions, Harvard this year has recognized Juneteenth and given people a day off, and I think Princeton as well. So, you know, I'm fine with it. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, when we're talking about myths, let's talk about the myth of Texas. What do you mean when you write in the book, Texas is a white man?
I mean that the construction of Texas, the way people present Texas as a place of cowboys, even though most people don't know that there were black cowboys, but the Hollywood version of Texas that is exemplified in the classic movie Giant, and every piece of writing about Texas has to deal with Giant, where you have the cattle rancher, the cowboy, and the oil man as the archetypes of Texans and what it means to be a Texan. And that's just not the only story. They're part of it, but that's not the only story. And particularly when you leave out the plantation owner, the people in East Texas who came to that part of Texas to extend the cotton empire and to create a cotton empire in that space, cotton and sugar cane with enslaved people. And so once you introduce that, you understand, I think, more clearly that the society is much more complicated than a story about the West and cattle and oil. It is part of the South. It's Southwest, but there's the Southern part of it that gets obscured. Yeah. And because of that, you don't think about the people. When you think about Southern society, you think of whites and blacks, enslaved blacks. But if you remove plantation society, then it becomes a version of Texas that is left, that's left is one that talks about the West and about men and, you know, their examples of what Texas is supposed to be.
It's interesting, too, the way you mention how, and I guess it hadn't occurred to me, but this is right, that, as you say, no other state really brings together so many defining characteristics of the country all in one as Texas. You've got all the major, I think you say, currents of our history are right there in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Westward expansion, the contest between indigenous people and Europeans, Latino culture versus Anglo culture, you know, plantation slavery, Jim Crow, the aftermath of all of that. It's borders of foreign country, so immigration comes into the mix. There's no place that has all of those things in one spot. And so even though Texas seems weird to people, I'm always called upon to explain Texas. Like, what's up with that? What's going on here? Texas really is the American story in that one space. So there's the paradox, a place that presents itself. And we kind of, I suppose, promote that notion of being unique and exotic. But it really is very, very American. But just, and all those volatile things in this one place make it the place that it is, one where there's always stuff going on. It seems to be sort of roiling controversies, roiling disputes in a place where all of these things are colliding.
I want to talk about one of the things you write about how the story of the black experience, when it's told, enslaved African Americans, is, you describe it as being highly edited, that it has this kind of, it limited the, as you put it, the imaginative possibilities of blackness. That slavery, of course, was awful, but as you say, it never destroyed their personhood. So talk a little bit about that, because Estebanico, for example, this North African, is one of the people that you write about and had this great talent for languages. And just talk a little bit about how that sort of is in the contrast to the images that we have of black people in history.
Well, I do talk about Estebanico. He was someone who was mentioned in passing in either my fourth grade or seventh grade Texas history class. We have to take Texas history twice. And he came to the area that was Texas, that would become Texas, with, among other people, Cabeza de Vaca. Everybody knows Cabeza de Vaca.
Yeah.
But it was an expedition of a couple of hundred people that gets dwindled down by the time they cross, they go originally go to Florida, and they end up crossing the Gulf of Mexico in rafts. And by the time they get there, and after disputes and after battles with indigenous people, they're reduced down to four. And he's one of four people. And they basically walk, they're enslaved for a time by these people, and they end up walking across Texas and Mexico to the Pacific seaboard. And along the way, Estevanico at times served as a translator for them because of his talent for languages. And I think, you know, he was enslaved. I mean, his condition was changed once they dwindled down to four people, and they were four men who were trying to survive together. And once they get to the Spanish mission, then everything becomes, things tend to go back to where they were before. But I think the knowledge, what I say is that the knowledge that there were people like Estevanico and others who came with Spanish explorers who were in Texas and that area, went into Mexico, sometimes leaving the Spanish and going off on their own and founding villages, being parts of villages and so forth, and creating, you know, a genetic heritage of African people in Mexico and Central America and South America, that if we had opened this up a bit and didn't just think about people who spoke English, you know, there are blacks in Texas, blacks in Florida and St. Augustine, 100 years before Jamestown. You know, if we thought about that, we would understand that the black experience is not just limited, was not just limited to, you know, the plantation experience. We're not, you know, an invention of British, of Great Britain. There are the points of commonality between black people who spoke Spanish and French and English were that they were brought from the African continent to be enslaved, and that they lived under a system of white supremacy. That they had that in common. The fact that the people who held them spoke different languages should not determine how we view other people of African descent. So the idea was to broaden our understanding of what it means to be black and or African American, that it includes people who don't speak the language, but people who had similar experiences in the New World, in the so-called New World.
Yeah. That assumption that African Americans were only used for hard labor, where does that come from? I mean, that's just an interesting kind of remnant, I think.
You know, I think it comes from Hollywood to a degree, the presentation of slavery as, you know, antebellum slavery, cotton, people think about cotton. They don't think as much about tobacco or rice or sugar cane. They don't think as much about the fact that black people worked in mines. They worked in factories in the South. It was a varied institution and doing lots of different things, lots of capabilities. And not to say that agricultural workers did not have complexity in their lives, but reducing it to one thing, I think, limits people's understandings about African Americans. And to the extent that we're connected to them, which I think we are, it sort of tells a story about black incapacity or black limitation. And an expansive knowledge of the capabilities and the activities of enslaved people will work against this notion of black limitation, that there were many things going on, they were doing many things, and it doesn't make sense to think of them just in terms of plantation agricultural slavery.
Yeah. Let's talk about the way you tell the stories of indigenous people in the Texas experience and the American experience. Talk a little bit about how important that was, that part of the history here.
I wanted to approach this subject from a different perspective. I mean, again, Indians are a part of the Hollywood presentation of Texas. Yeah. And one of the things that I say in the book is that I grew up thinking from watching, you know, television and from what I heard, it was almost as if Native peoples were people of the past. And that's the name of the chapter, People of the Past and the Present, because they are of the present. They're here. They weren't all killed off. But the presentation was, oh, there were these people, they were here and now they're gone. But I happened to be born about 17 miles from the Alabama Coushatta Indian Reservation. And we used to go there. This was in the 70s. And that was sort of the height of romanticizing, in some ways, Native Americans. There was sort of the back to the land movement. And they were presented as the people who were the true visionaries about cultivation of land and so forth, which was easy in romanticizing them after moving them off of the land and, you know, making them mascots, that kind of romanticizing. So we went to Indian reservations and I knew they were still there and they were still present. And at the same time, I thought, and because of my father, who romanticized Native Americans in another way, because he thought that there was a natural alliance. There was likely a natural alliance between Native Americans and Black people. And it was interesting to me later on to find out that that was not the case. And there should never have thought that that was the case. We would have sort of grafting our racial views onto the people in the past. And indeed, some Native Americans and some indigenous people and African Americans did form common, you know, bonds, but other Native Americans held African Americans as slaves. And they too, right now, just as the country is supposed to be coming to some sort of reckoning about slavery, are doing that right now too, for the groups of people who, for whom this is appropriate, are trying to figure out what to do about the legacy of slavery among Native Americans.
The American story is endlessly complicated. That's a good indicator of that.
Yep. Because I find out, and I talk a little bit about this as well, that we think of slavery just in terms of African American slavery, but there was slavery of Indians by Europeans as well. I mean, the story was, you know, this was their land and they were too resourceful. They couldn't be enslaved, but that's not the case. There was Indian slavery and some people moved from the American mainland to the West Indies and certainly Native slavery up in the Great Lakes area. So, yes, it's very complicated.
Annette Gordon-Reed, she teaches at Harvard University. Her new book is called On Juneteenth. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER would like to thank our members for helping us bring trustworthy news and information to Utah. When you become a financial contributor to the station, you can keep track of your donation online with MyKUER. It's our online portal that lets you manage your payment information, change the amount of your donation, find tax receipts, and more. Sign up for an account at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Annette Gordon-Reed. In her new book, she writes about sharing the Juneteenth holiday with the rest of the country. But her focus is on Texas, where it started, because she says the state embodies the larger story of America. The book is also a memoir. It's called On Juneteenth. You were the one to integrate this school in your town. And the story about it, your father, like there wasn't a bunch of, you know, news cameras. There wasn't a lot of coverage. Your dad basically dropped you off. It's such an interesting story that it wasn't more dramatic, even though I'm sure there was plenty of hard feelings and difficult feelings on, you know, a lot of sides here. But would you just talk a little bit about that story and the way your parents were thinking about that and the decision to send you to a white school? Because you talk particularly about your father, how he felt about that.
Mm-hmm. Their attitude about this changed over time. Their explanation for why they did this changed over time. It became more pragmatic, I would say. They said, well, you know, we knew that the Supreme Court was going to strike down the Freedom of Choice plan. And we didn't know when they were going to do it, but you would be in place when that happened. And my father said, well, the white school district was divided into by age. There was mm-hmm. elementary school, intermediate school, junior high, and high school. And Booker T. Washington was K through 12. And he thought, you know, I wanted, you know, he said, I wanted you to go to an elementary school. He thought if white people were doing that for their kids and this, you know, spending money to do that, that this was probably the thing to do.
Yeah.
But I think they were probably more idealistic than they let on. They became gradually sort of disillusioned about the effectiveness of integration. And they seemed not to want to appear idealistic. This was my impression of why, because I had a sense when I was a kid that this was something that was important and they thought was important to do. And it wasn't just about, you know, the court is going to strike down. They thought that they were doing something in the spirit of the times. This is the mid-60s and there was the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act. And this was a part of that. Black people were on the move, so to speak. So this was a part of their idealism that they drew back from when they saw some of the effects of integration. One being that the children were integrated across the South, but the teachers were not.
Yeah.
A lot of Black teachers were taken out of the classroom and Black students lost role models. And I should say, white students lost the opportunity to have Black teachers as role right. models, which was right. important as well. And so they didn't want to appear as if they had been, I think, again, they're no longer living and I can't have the conversation with them about them. But this yeah. is from looking at what I remember as a child and what they were telling me later on, there seemed to be a revision about what they were doing and what they thought they were doing once they saw the effects of all of it.
You know, I was really taken by the section in the book where you talk about your mother remained as a teacher and you write about about how Black teachers interacting with Black students, that they saw themselves as not necessarily role models of activism, but just talking about the role of asserting yourself, asserting your rights as human beings. That was an important part of that relationship, it seemed, between Black teachers and Black students.
Oh, yeah. They were members of the same community. Mm. As wonderful as my teachers were to me, they didn't live in our community. Mm. They did not socialize, as far as I know, with other Black people. And we were all Texans, but as I see in the book, we were subdivided by race. We lived in separate communities and went to different churches, and it makes a difference. I talk about playing outside with my friends, and then all of a sudden they would disappear yeah. after school. I went, where did everybody go? What is this? And I finally figured out that one of their teachers, it would happen when one of their teachers was riding down the road, and they didn't want to be seen by their teachers outside playing when they should have been inside doing their homework. And I think it's because, well, they knew that the teachers knew their parents and that there may be some conversation why they out not doing their homework or whatever. School was an extension of, or was a part of the community. School was everywhere. So it wasn't just what happened in the classroom. It was, you know, how you conducted yourself in the neighborhood. These people were around you. They were watching you. They talked to your parents. And so that mission, that sense of mission that my mother had, I mean, she said to me one time, you know, I can't talk to them the way we used to talk to them, meaning yeah. Black students. Mm-hmm. We couldn't say, you know, folks, you have to do this because, you know, essentially we're on the march here, meaning they tried to tie the children to some mission that was about not just themselves, but about Black people overall. And, you know, thinking back on Juneteenth, the idea that our circumstances have changed, these are the circumstances we're in now, and how are we going to go forward? And she said she went to school, went to college, went to Spelman and went to TSU for graduate school to teach Black students. She loved all of her students, and she was a popular teacher. But that mission of training Black students for what they were going to face was lost when integration came. So there are good points about it and bad points about it. And again, back to my point about thinking about the good and bad in history, you have to face both of those strands and decide, you know, obviously, ultimately, you couldn't have a society where people are divided by law, by race. I mean, that's antithetical to a notion of equal citizenship. But you do have to be realistic about some of the things that were lost when that happened. Hmm.
I was really taken by something that you had said about, and I was trying to imagine the experience of you going off and going to school as the one Black person, you know, girl in a school of white people, and then coming home to your Black community, coming home to your Black friends. And one of the things you've talked about was about being detached and separated is something that you kind of got used to doing. And in some ways, and I don't want to overstate this because I know you worried about psychoanalyzing yourself when you were talking about this, but that in some way it may account for, as you've said, the detachment that you bring to your projects as an historian. Would you say something about that? Do you mind?
I think that is likely true. It's hard to say. It's a chicken and egg thing.
Yeah.
Was I able to survive this in a good way? Because I was naturally a detached person, analytical person, or did that create that in me or foster it, being able to stand outside a situation and look at it and say, what is going on here? Because that's a persistent feature of my personality. And I think it may have been, I may be naturally inclined that way, but I certainly think that my experiences at Anderson, those early experiences, contributed to that and made that tendency even stronger.
The Juneteenth celebration, you describe it as when you were a kid, as a day of excess for you and your friends. Drank a lot of soda water. It was great. But you also write about one food item that I wanted to ask you about that became a part of the tradition for you. Your grandmother made hot tamales.
Yes. My grandmother and my mother made hot tamales, but mainly my grandmother, to raise money. She started doing this to raise money for the St. Luke Methodist Church, to build a new church. And a friend of my mother's, we used to buy tamales as a kid, sometimes as a treat. And they got this idea that they would start making them to raise money. And for holidays, people would come, and they loved my grandmother's tamales. And they would come and they would order huge numbers of them on holidays. And Juneteenth was one of those days where people would put in orders for them. And that meant that I had to help. I have to confess, and I say in the book, I would rather have been doing other things at the time, because you're a little kid. And now, again, I look back at that and I really wished I had understood how important that was to be sitting there with those women making this dish that is not an African dish. It's not a dish that, you know, you think of as any other part of America. It's Texas and California. And it became a defining feature of one of the defining features of our celebrations when I was growing up.
You have people of African descent celebrating the end of slavery with dishes connected to indigenous people in the Mexican past. That just seems perfect.
Yes, it does. I mean, it says everything about the multi-ethnic, multicultural, multiracial nature of slavery, of Texas from the beginning. I mean, people think of diversity now as something that is newfangled in different parts of the country. Here, it was from the very beginning. There were different groups of people contending and dealing with one another from the earliest parts of Texas history, before it was Texas.
You have said, Professor, that there's this kind of irony, that part of the mythology of Texas is that it's this place that looks to the future without fear. But you've also said that you are seeing what could be described as fear, as current Texans think about the future. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes, I think one of the things that has always distinguished Texans for me, particularly when I started writing about Virginia and the South and thinking about the old South, is that, you know, Texans pay attention to the past. They have the 300 families that who are supposed to be the original people who came to Texas and so forth, all that kind of thing. And there's a social aspect, a socialite aspect to Texas, but not nearly so much, I think, as places like Virginia that think of themselves as having had an outright aristocracy. And they call themselves FFV, First Families of Virginia. I got a card from somebody who had that on it, FFV. And, you know, we do that to some degree in Texas, but Texas, as I said, is about the future. What's next? And it's interesting to me now to see people holding on to the past or holding on to a version of the past that's really untenable. I mean, there's no way to talk about the Texas Republic without talking about slavery and without talking about race. And the fear of confronting that just seems to me to be un-Texan, not very Texan-like, to be able to look at this and say, it is what it is. Now, what are we going to do? How are we going to go forward? You hope that people aren't going to say, yeah, those people were right. Slavery was okay, and Black people shouldn't be citizens of Texas. But you have to acknowledge that they were wrong, but that we can still go forward. There's enough for everybody there if we work together and if we don't try to destroy one another. So it does seem strange to me to see this defensive reaction when you know that people made mistakes in the past and you know that people have recovered from them and they go forward. But worshiping a past that is untruthful, that doesn't get us anywhere, doesn't seem to me to be where we want to go as Texans. Says the New Yorker now.
Right. Well,
where we want to go.
Yeah. Well, there's this question that comes up that you write about in the book. What is it that you love about Texas still? Even after having, you know, raised questions about these legends and these myths, you say that there are, of course, problems about loving something that's based on a myth. So as you put it in the book, how do you feel about the history that's left?
Well, what we have to do is focus on the history that is left. We can take parts of mythology that are useful to us. One of the most interesting things that happened a few days ago is after the people walked out, the Democrats walked out to reduce the quorum, to lose the quorum in the legislature when they were trying to pass these bills, these draconian bills. Someone said, this is our Alamo. This is our last stand. And I thought, what an irony. I mean, after all I've said about, written about the Alamo and how the Republic was, you know, a part of what they were fighting for was to preserve slavery. Yeah. Somebody takes this story, the mythos of the Alamo, extracts this point about duty and stick-to-itiveness and applies it to their circumstances. So the story is remade by this particular act. So I think, it's possible to have, as I do, affectionate feelings about the state because of the experiences that I had there. It's also possible to be realistic about the history of the state. I can know these things about it, but still think that there's something valuable in the idea of having a spirit of being future oriented, being open. I mean, the thought is that Texas is supposed to be a friendly place, and people dispute that, but that it's a place of being friendly and open and meeting the future without fear. You can transform the mythology. We can make it into the things that we need for a state that is made up of lots of different kind of people, most of whom love the state and want to see the best for it.
Yeah. And you say when you love something, it requires you take a critical stance.
Yes, it does. I mean, you can't just assume that because you love, if you're a parent, you recognize that your child is not always right. Sometimes the teacher might be right, their friends might be right, or a spouse or anyone. You have to have, or yourself, for myself, I have to have a realistic assessment of my strengths and weaknesses if I want to improve, if I want to be better. And loving something uncritically, to my mind, is self-indulgent. It's not real love, because you're not trying to make the person or the place or the thing that you're dealing with better. And being critical is a necessary part of it.
Professor Annette Gordon-Reed, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, you're very, very welcome.
Annette Gordon-Reed, she's an historian and professor at Harvard University. Her new book is on Juneteenth. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you or on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Carter Wolf, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.